So my apologies to those of you who thought you were coming here for a talk on non-equilibrium physics. I'm going to take you on a tour of some areas of the phase diagram in QCD where I believe there's been very interesting recent work. Unfortunately, so far to date, all of that work has been in thermal equilibrium. But I believe the questions that are raised here would be very useful ones to address using the methods that people have been discussing at this workshop. So I hope you'll forgive me for beginning with baby steps and talking about thermal equilibrium. So the work that I'm going to talk about, not all of it has been done by me, but the parts of it that have been done by me have been done in collaboration with this list of people. Mark and Jürgen are postdocs at MIT. Misha is a postdoc at Stony Brook. Edward and Frank, I presume, are more well known to all of you. Okay, I have a couple of trends. This is a very mixed audience. Particularly last week, there were a lot of people here interested in cosmological reheating. I'm not sure if I really. This is less mixed than I thought it would be. I don't think I need to begin with what QCD is. I will say a few words about the reason. I won't even show this transparency. I won't show this transparency. I will assume that you all know what asymptotic freedom is. Basically, in quantum field theory, the vacuum is just another medium, and it can screen or anti-screen. And in QCD, it anti-screens. So the consequences of this, at low energies, it's an experimental consequence that the interaction, it's an experimental consequence of the fact that the interactions are strong at low energies, that quarks and gluons occur only in colorless packages called protons, neutrons, and pions. On the other hand, at high energies and short distances, the interactions are weak, and you see quarks and gluons every day at Fermilab and Hera if you look with a powerful enough microscope. So the question that is of interest in this talk is, can we find a phase of matter in which QCD actually looks like QCD? So can I find a phase in which QCD looks like a theory of quarks and gluons rather than a theory of hadrons? I don't want to say the word deconfinement because that's not really a precisely defined concept in a theory with light quarks. So I posed the question in an imprecise way. So there are two ways one might think of doing this. One might think of heating up matter, going up to a high enough temperature that protons, neutrons, and the like boil. The temperatures are thought to be required are of order 150 MeV. The other way of going is to take a chunk of matter, keep it cold, and squeeze it until the protons and neutrons overlap so that the notion of confinement no longer makes any sense. If you had 1,000 quarks within a volume of one Fermi cubed, there's no longer any sense in talking about confinement. Okay, so the arena for this talk is the phase diagram in QCD as a function of temperature and density. And before I actually begin the talk, I'll just remind you where in nature this phase diagram has been or will be explored. The whole universe explored this vertical axis as it cooled after the Big Bang. It went through this temperature when it was at the ripe old age of about 10 microseconds. And to a very good approximation on the scales that matter here, the universe is at baryon number density 0. In relevant units, it's at baryon number density 10 to the minus 9. And so on this transparency, on this scale, the universe cooled down the vertical axis. The horizontal axis, well, nuclei exist somewhere here on the horizontal axis. And neutron stars exist somewhere to the right of ordinary nuclear matter density, it not being clear whether they are in the ordinary familiar hadronic phase or in some new phase. Then how do you explore the plane as opposed to the two axes? The experimental way of exploring the plane is to take two of these guys, slam them together at high enough energies that you hope to create some small volume of space, which for a short time is in conditions in some approximate equilibrium somewhere out here, which then cool as they expand and go back through the transition. Now, when I say new phase of matter in which the theory looks like a theory of quarks and gluons, that doesn't mean that the theory is simple. The fact that G is small does not mean that that non-perturbative physics isn't important. We've heard a lot about that, and we'll hear a lot more about that on the vertical axis. As you go to very large temperatures, G becomes small, but nevertheless there's intricate and important non-perturbative physics having to do with long wavelength modes, say wavelength of order, momentum of order g squared t. Similarly on the high density side, it's possible for there to be, even though g is small, it's possible for there to be interesting non-perturbative physics. So you need not just have this phase out here, need not be a naive quark gluon plasma, whatever you have in your mind by a naive quark gluon plasma. It can be as rich and interesting and complicated as all of condensed matter physics, if you think about it. There are many possible phenomena that can occur even when g is small. It can probably be more rich, more complicated, more interesting than condensed matter physics because of the non-abelian nature. Okay, so I want to begin by talking about the QCD phase diagram with, for the moment, two massless quarks. I will increase from 2 to 3 at some point, and I will introduce the quark masses at some point, but for the moment, two massless quarks. Now, in the QCD, in the vacuum of this theory, there is a non-zero expectation value for a chiral condensate, psi bar left, psi right, which breaks a global symmetry. And it is thought that the presence of a non-zero expectation value for this operator is a consequence of the strength of the interactions, and that if you go to large temperature or large density, when the effect of coupling gets weak, you expect this symmetry to be restored. Now, what is known about how this symmetry gets restored? Well, if you crank up the temperature but stay, sorry, mu is chemical potential for baryon numbers. So if you stay at zero density and crank up the temperature, you can then make an argument a la Wilson that suggests that a second order phase transition is possible. You basically look for the long wavelength theory which would describe the order parameter associated with this symmetry restoration, and you find that it has O4 symmetry, and then you ask your condensed matter colleagues, does such, and is there a second order phase transition in that universality class? Answer is yes. So you now know that there is a possible second order transition. It is possible for there to be a second order transition. You then go and do lattice simulations of the full gauge theory, not just the long wavelength effective theory, and you find that the correct statement is that there are no signs of first order behavior. It is not yet true that the lattice gauge theory people have measured O4 exponents. There have been papers on this subject, but I think this is not this question. The question of whether the exponents agree is not settled. What is true is that there is no sign of first order behavior. So for this talk, I will just assume that in this theory with two massless quarks, when you crank up the vertical axis, you get a second order transition. I'll just take that as an assumption. Now, on the horizontal axis, much less is known. Much less is known for many reasons. Chief among them, there are no lattice gauge theory simulations. At non-zero chemical potential, the measure that you would use for a simulation in lattice gauge theory is no longer real, no longer real and positive, so you have problems with Monte Carlo methods. So there are no practical lattice gauge theory simulations for full QCD at non-zero chemical potential. So you have to rely on models, and it seems that in many models you get a first order transition, and I will not defend that statement in this talk. I will just take it as an assumption because it leads to interesting consequences, and it is suggested by many models, but let me not try and give you a catalog of models. So what does this suggest? This suggests that in this theory with two massless quarks, there's some region in this plane where psi bar psi is non-zero. There's some region out here where psi bar psi vanishes. There must be a red line separating these two regions. This red line is second order here. It's first order there. Now, you could guess that there were a series of alternations going first, second, first, second, first, second. But Occam suggests that it's much simpler just to guess that there's one tricritical point where the order of the transition changes. The last third of my talk will be about physics near here. The first part of my talk and the larger part of my talk will be about physics out here. What happens if you go out to high densities and stay at low temperatures? So this psi bar psi condensate vanishes, but I will try and describe the fact that life is certainly not simple out there. So the two parts of my talk, I will first talk about QCD at finite density and low temperature. As I've already said, much less is known on this axis than on the vertical axis, and so much less is known that there have been developments within the last year or so in our understanding of what the symmetries are of the lowest energy state. So if you want, understanding the equilibrium physics is the first step. Understanding what the symmetries are is the zeroth step, and we're still working on the zeroth step. Yes.
In principle, with two light labeled ports and the weak interaction switched off, you could have two chemical potentials.
Correct.
Is anything known in models about?
No. Well, that has not been studied in any serious way that I'm aware of. It's of course of interest because in nuclear matter you don't have equal numbers of ups and downs. The kinds of condensates that I'm going to describe all actually favor equal up and down chemical potential, and so they would tend to try and drive the system in that direction if allowed, and that can actually lead to potential signatures in heavy ion physics. I'm getting ahead of myself. I don't believe this physics is likely to be relevant in heavy ion collisions because it requires too low temperatures. I'll say that again a little later. The last part of my talk will be physics at near that tricritical point, which is at non-zero temperature and density, and this will lead to suggestions for signatures in heavy ion experiments. Okay, so how might we try and treat QCD at high density? I've already said lattice fails. We know a lot about the non-perturbative physics of gauge theories, which happen to be supersymmetric. Can we apply that here? I think the answer is no, because a high density of squarks is very different than a high density of quarks. So I think this is a non-starter. Large N may definitely be worth thinking about. Again, you have to be careful about the fact that baryons are fermions or bosons, depending on the evenness or oddness of N. Also, NC equals 3 will matter in the following. So I'm not sure. No one has really tried this, but well, a high density of quarks. You'll see. And equal it. Many of the things that I'm going to say are particular to the case n equals 3. Is what I meant to say. And in what way they're particular, you'll see. So, another possibility is to use perturbation theory. At high enough densities, when G gets small, this should be valid. This, naively, as I've said, leads us to expect chiral symmetry to be restored. As I will show you, this is not at all clear that... I will give you an example where this, in fact, may not happen. And already from perturbation theory, you expect this phenomenon, which has appeared on several transparencies already, namely color superconductivity, which I will now explain. What is color superconductivity? So think about physics at asymptotically high densities, two-flavor QCD. So I have quarks filling Fermi Cs out to some very large Fermi energy. And what Cooper of BCS teaches us to ask, if you have fermions at a Fermi surface, the question you're supposed to ask is there an attractive interaction between those fermions? Well, because of asymptotic freedom, the quarks at the Fermi surface should be weakly interacting, but what Cooper tells you is that any attractive interaction, no matter how weak, leads to an instability of the Fermi surface. The way that instability manifests itself is the formation of Cooper pairs, which in the language that I'm going to use is a non-zero expectation value for a quark-quark operator. So an ordinary superconductor will be a non-zero expectation value of EE via the formation of Cooper pairs. Here it's QQ. So is there an attractive interaction? Yes. One gluon exchange is attractive for two quarks which are antisymmetric in color, so in the color 3-bar channel. The inciton interaction is also attractive in this channel. And an attractive interaction in this channel will lead to a condensate which is in the color 3, so alpha and beta are my color indices. They run from 1 to 3. This epsilon alpha beta gamma here has an uncontracted gamma index. And that reflects the fact that you all know, that if you have two quarks, you cannot have a color singlet. And this particular combination of color indices is, in fact, the color 3-bar. So it picks a direction in color space. If I take gamma to be blue, if I call the colors red, green, and blue, then if I take gamma to be blue, this condensate involves only the red and green quarks. The blue quarks are not participating if gamma happens to point in the blue direction. The attractive channel turns out to be a flavor singlet in a two-flavor theory, epsilon ij, qi, qj. It turns out to be a Lorentz scalar. You'll just have to trust me that qc gamma phi q is the Lorentz scalar and not the pseudoscalar. It's just true. So this condensate doesn't break any flavor symmetries. It doesn't break any global symmetries. But it breaks SU3 color, leaving an unbroken SU2. So it gives mass to 5 of the gluons by the, I should really call this the Anderson mechanism in this context. and leaves three of them massless. I'll say more about electromagnetism in a minute. So in pictures, the phase diagram, this picture is due to Mark Alford. The handwritten transparencies are my own. In pictures, the phase out here, he made it yellow because it's red. It involves the red and green quarks. The blue quarks are floating around uncondensed, so there's still a blue quark Fermi surface. You can ask, is that Fermi surface of blue quarks unstable? It turns out it is unstable, it's unstable and it forms a condensate which actually is ferromagnetic in the sense that it breaks rotation invariants. But this instability, as we'll see, leads to a critical temperature in the tens of MeV. This one down here, a critical temperature less than a keV. So you can forget about this, and in fact, I won't discuss it in this talk. But if you're wondering, is the blue quark Fermi surface unstable? The answer is yes, it is, but the instability is resolved by a much smaller gap.
So this line that has the rot?
That says rotational. This one?
No, the line that separates the pink from the white.
Pink from the white, right here.
Right.
Yeah.
That boundary would convert the color superconductor into a dual color superconductor.
Well, wait. Well, no. This is the line at above and below here. The red and green quarks are doing the same thing. Above and below here, the blue quarks either do or do not form this ferromagnetic condensate, which I'm not describing for you. It's a spin 1 condensate which picks a direction in space, and I'm not going to describe it. And if you were going to ask me about the order of this transition, I don't know the answer.
I was thinking about the boundary to the white space, which is...
Oh, up here?
No. Oh,
right here. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, pardon me. Sorry, now what was the question?
At that boundary, the first order, you could have coexistence between a color superconductor and a dual color superconductor.
Yes. That's a very prescient comment, which we'll come back to.
The tadpole growing off the bottom axis?
Ah, yes, okay. The tadpole growing, this is very well-known nuclear physics. If you ask, this is a chemical potential axis. This axis is chemical potential, not density. If you imagine starting in vacuum and cranking up the chemical potential, you in fact have zero density until you get to a chemical potential at which it becomes until you get to a chemical potential at which you can start creating baryons. So this is what's called the onset transition. So here I have a coexistence between vacuum and nuclear matter. As I crank the chemical potential up further, I squeeze the nuclear matter. And if you go up this axis, this first order transition ends at a liquid gas critical point, which has actually been studied in what are called multi-fragmentation experiments in nuclear physics. And I wasn't planning to talk about that. I could after. To give you a sense of the scale, this temperature is about 10 MeV, so this plot is not really to scale, because this is 10 MeV, this is 150 MeV. So this is low temperature nuclear physics. Well, low temperature relative to what I'm talking about. Okay, so the weakest thing about the analyses that I'm going to tell you about of color superconductivity are the models. The models that have been used are completely toy models, with one exception. I'll mention the exception when I get to it. I think what's robust is the channel which what we can say about the channels which condense, because that seems to be my sense is that that's robust. The models are not supposed to be realistic. So the simplest model that we could think of to start with was to think of a model of fermions with a Hamiltonian, which has a kinetic term as for free quarks, and some four fermion interaction. And this is sort of amusing because this kind of a model is what is now called the Nambu-Jones-Lasigno model. And if you go back and read the paper of Nambu and Jones-Lasigno, they were directly inspired by BCS when they constructed their model. What we are now doing is using an NJL model to analyze a BCS phenomenon, so it's sort of amusing. Okay, what for Fermi interaction? We decided that on this transparency is Alford, Wilczek, and myself. We decided that the simplest interaction we could think of it using was a four Fermi interaction abstracted from the instanton interaction in QCD. Why choose that? Because it breaks all the symmetries that QCD breaks. It restores, it respects all the symmetries that QCD respects. But of course, you should feel free to redo our analysis using other operators. There are other operators that are equally just as relevant as this one. This one just, all those other operators don't change the symmetry of the theory, but they're just as relevant. And this, in fact, has now been done, which I'll come to. Yes.
At zero.
Correct. At zero density, this breaks chiral symmetry, and that's, we're going to use that to normalize it. So to be explicit, there's my interaction Hamiltonian. It's a four Fermi interaction. All these indices come out of a Tuft's paper. You then need to somehow crudely, if I just stop there, this would be nothing like QCD because it grows in the ultraviolet. So we need to make it fall in the ultraviolet. So we do so by multiplying each fermion leg by a form factor. We chose a fairly, well, a completely ad hoc two-parameter form factor. And as I said, the model is weak. What's what? Nu was a parameter that we put in just so that we could vary the shape of the form factor. So we have a two-parameter form factor. Lambda sets the scale, and nu was one parameter we put in so that we could change the shape of the form factor. There's no physics in lambda or nu.
Is there any physics in F?
Well, there is physics in F in the sense that the theory without F is not
controllable.
Right.
But for large P,
Right. So if you believe in instantons as the explanation for everything in QCD, then you can go to your favorite instanton liquid model and try and extract an F by doing the appropriate Fourier transform over the instanton fields. And this has now been done by Carter and Diakonov. It's a lot of work, and it gives the same answers. And if you want to do better than that, I'll tell you how in a minute. Okay. So just to warm up, how does one use this kind of a model to study chiral symmetry breaking in the vacuum? This is what Nambu and John Lozinho did. You write down a variational wave function in which you start with the vacuum the vacuum state. And for each color, for each flavor, for each momentum, you act with an operator written here. With probability cosquared theta, this operator does nothing. With probability sine squared theta, it makes a particle and an antiparticle pair. And what are these thetas? These thetas are variational parameters. They're supposed to be found by minimizing the expectation value of H, or once we go to non-zero chemical potential, minimizing the expectation value of H minus mu n. And in pictures, what you're doing is allowing for the possibility of pairing between this quark and this antiquark. And you can see from this picture that as soon as I turn on a non-zero density, I've then filled up all of these states. And once all of these states are full, that operator, that pairing operator, which was trying to create a particle there and an antiparticle there, can't act because it can't create particles in here. So this already tells you that this form of order is disfavored by high density. As you crank the Fermi surface up, you have fewer and fewer states that can participate in this pairing. And the way that comes out in the equations is that when you vary psi with respect to the thetas, you find a solution. There's theta. Theta is given in terms of a quantity phi, which you defined, and phi is defined to satisfy this equation, which is called a gap equation. And if you look at this equation and ask what are its properties, let's ask, does it have a solution with phi non-zero? You can see that the right-hand side here, there's nothing singular about this integral. So if I set phi to 0, this right-hand side is finite. And if k is therefore very small, the entire right-hand side will be less than 1. Turning on a phi only reduces the right-hand side. So if k is very small, there will be no solution to this equation, and phi is 0. When k gets larger than some threshold, you can find non-zero solutions phi. And, okay, so what we do, we normalize the strength of our interaction by making it give a vacuum chiral condensate of a reasonable value, and we then play with those other parameters and explore the robustness of what we're talking about by playing with the other parameters, having normalized its strength. So, I told you that this familiar ordering is disfavored at high density. But there's another kind of ordering which is favored at high density, namely pairing not between this and this, but pairing between this particle and this particle, or this hole and this hole, or very unlikely, this antiparticle and this antiparticle. And this kind of pairing is favored as the Fermi surface goes up. Fermi energy goes up because as the Fermi energy goes up, the Fermi surface gets larger, and the states that are involved in this pairing are those near the Fermi surface. So how do we see that? We again construct a trial wave function. This time, for each flavor, each color, and each momentum, you either don't or do create a particle-particle pair, a hole-hole pair, or an antiparticle-antiparticle pair. I've forgotten which is. There's some. One of these should be a C, but anyway. And you then, again, you vary the thetas. You find a solution for the thetas. I can give you the solution for the thetas. The thetas are given in terms of a quantity you introduce, which I'm going to call delta. And delta then satisfies the gap equation, and here it is. So this is the gap equation for the superconducting gap delta. And if I now look at this, I say, wait a minute, if I put delta to 0, the right-hand side is infinite. The right-hand side is infinite because there's a log divergence when p is equal to mu at the Fermi surface. Log divergence at the Fermi surface, so the right-hand side is infinite. And that tells me that I have to have a non-zero delta because, again, putting in a non-zero delta reduces the right-hand side. But since the right-hand side started out infinite with no delta, that there must be a non-zero delta. So this is what Cooper discovered, namely that so long as the interaction has the appropriate sign, no matter how weak it is, there will be a non-zero condensate.
The variational wave function you wrote down has several different thetas. You set them all equal?
The variation actually tells you. The variation turns out to tell you that they're solved by these equations.
So they're not
They're not equal, actually. They're not equal, but you vary each of them, and so.
Your equation implies some law bound of what you call nu, isn't it? It shouldn't be too small, otherwise your integral will not diverge.
Yes.
Where does it come from?
Let me just saying that too quickly. No, wait. I was going too quickly. Well, nu should be, if nu is positive, you're okay.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think.
No.
Oh, wait.
PDP S4 should converge, so F should fall out some. F has to fall out. So positivity is not
one half.
One half,
yeah.
Or one or something.
One quarter.
Yes. Well, so that's a constraint on your toy model. If you violated that, it wouldn't make any sense. And I could now appeal to the hard work of Carter and Diakonoff to say that didn't happen. So what the kinds of gaps that we get as a function of chemical potential for two different choices of lambda, the kinds of gaps that we get are of order 100 MeV. That's all I wanted to show from this plot. We played around with varying nu and varying lambda, but because we're fitting the magnitude of the strength of the attraction to a physical quantity, namely the vacuum expectation value of psi bar psi, the vertical scale of the typical gaps that we get do in fact turn out to be of order 100 MeV, relatively independent of what we do with the form factor, unless we do something pathological, as was just suggested. Okay, so we want to do better than that. I've talked about high densities and I've talked about zero densities, but I want to study transitions. So what Jürgen Berges and I did was to do a mean field analysis, which is completely equivalent to the variational one that I've just presented, but I'm not going to go through the details. We constructed the thermodynamic potential, the one which is at a solution equal to minus the pressure. So this will be a function of the chemical potential and the temperature and a function of phi and delta, the chiral gap and the superconducting gap, and minima of this omega are solutions to the gap equations. And to give you an idea of the analysis that one does, at one particular temperature, namely zero, and one particular mu, there's omega as a function of the two gaps. And you can see that at this choice of temperature and chemical potential, there's a first order phase transition between a phase in which chiral symmetry is broken and there's no superconductivity, and a phase in which there's superconductivity and no chiral symmetry breaking. And by doing this, by making beautiful colored pictures at many t's and mu's, you make a phase diagram. And this phase diagram does in fact have the qualitative features that my sketch had earlier on. It has a second order transition up here. Of course, our analysis has been mean field, so the exponents we would get from our analysis would be mean field. But we expect that in reality, the second order phase transition would have O4 exponents because that's the symmetry that's being restored. The transition becomes first order at a tricritical point. And out here, we find a non-zero psi bar psi, sorry, a non-zero psi psi, so we find superconductivity, with a critical temperature which peaks at around 40 MeV. In our model, this transition turns out to be second order. I don't believe that. Just as in the electroweak theory, this is a phase transition between a theory in which a gauge symmetry is broken. So this is the Higgs phase for that gauge theory, and the Coulomb phase for that gauge theory. And you know from the electroweak theory that you can often have situations where in mean field theory you get a second order transition, but then gauge field fluctuations result instead in a fluctuation-induced first-order transition. I expect that's true here also. Or, in fact, it might even be a smooth crossover because there's actually no change in global symmetry associated with this transition. But in our mean field analysis, we get a mean field result, but that's not something to put a lot of weight on. This figure is the basis of something I said earlier, which is that this is probably irrelevant for heavy ion physics. In heavy ion physics, one can achieve relatively high densities, but say, at the AGS, where people think one might be achieving densities as large as 6 to 8 times nuclear, the temperatures are thought to be 100 MeV, which is low for heavy ion physics. And here I am at 40 MeV. Now, it's certainly true that we could easily be off by a factor of 2. So maybe we are off by a factor of 2, and in fact, this temperature is higher, and we're just on the edge. But at this point, I can't with a straight face say this is heavy ion physics. This is much more likely to be neutron star physics. And in a neutron star, by the way, this temperature is extremely high. Neutron star temperatures on this scale are way down here. Pardon me? Quark masses are coming.
How can a second order line end up at an ordinary first order point?
This is one reason why I don't believe it. Okay. What I believe actually happens right here is that this is a first order line and you have a triple point here with 3 coexisting phases. That's what I believe. Good. But what I don't know is whether that line stays first order all the way out here or whether it ends and becomes a crossover. Okay, so I've been telling you how to analyze this problem using this toy model. Improvements have occurred since the paper that I've been referring to. First of all, as I've mentioned already, Carter and Diakonoff have done, these improvements are ordered in terms of more and more improvement, I would say. Carter and Diakonoff did a much better treatment of the incitons than we did, although I'm not sure whether this is not just misplaced enthusiasm, because there is more to QCD than just the inciton. Now, you would like also to do an analysis which tells you which 4 Fermi interactions are actually important. And the way to formulate this is to set up a renormalization group in the way that Shankar and Polchinski have taught us to do, in which the blue sphere here is the Fermi surface, and you set up a renormalization group where as you reduce lambda, you're integrating out modes outside this shell of width 2 lambda about the Fermi surface, and keeping only those modes closer and closer to the Fermi surface. This renormalization group analysis was implemented for the most general point-like 4 Fermi interaction, sort of. So it's a set of, depending on how you count, I think they called it 14 different 4 Fermi interactions. That's sort of just a matter of counting. And this was done by 2 groups, Evans, Shu, and Schwetz, and Schaefer and Wilczek. And the point of this is to ask the question, what's the most important 4 Fermi interaction? What's the one that's most relevant at the Fermi surface? First of all, I should say that if you by hand choose only 1 4 Fermi interaction, this method reproduces the same gap equation that the variational method gives you. But this is a much more convenient way of analyzing the situation with many couplings. And what they find is that the actual coupling which matters is more complicated. There are many couplings that are equally relevant, but the condensate which results is the same as what we got. Another improvement which is in progress, the results are not yet out, you could take this theory, not QCD, but you can take a theory with a 4 Fermi interaction, cut off in some way, put it on the lattice, and simulate. So that goes beyond what's above this on the transparency. And Simon Hans and Susan Morrison are doing this, and they have some preliminary results. Simulated finite density. There's no. It turns out that, well, this is This is a seminar in itself, but it turns out that without the gauge interactions, there are ways of doing this. Let me just think for a minute. That basically, what they actually simulate is a theory with no sign problem. And they have to choose. They have to choose that there be. With Kogut-Suskind, it's all in the details. They use Kogut-Suskind fermions. They have to use the right number of Kogut-Suskind fermions. And they put in a. I'm not sure how to answer this quickly.
You can actually get the fermion determined if it's real and positive.
Correct.
Even though they have a chemical potential.
Correct. But it's not QCD.
No, I understood you to say that you start with 14 different Bohr fermion interactions and some fraction of them become relevant.
Correct.
I
think the two groups did the counting in slightly different ways, but yes.
So something like that, and some fraction of them are relevant.
Correct.
Some extra symmetry emerging, or what?
No.
No,
it's a mess.
Can you tell?
No, and of course they're all. I mean, they are in terms of power counting, in the correct sense of power counting for this kind of renormalization, they're all the same order.
Right.
So what they do is it's the following academic exercise, which is to say, suppose at some scale lambda, I start with them all the same strength,
right,
and then run, see which ones grow fastest. But that's just a question of the constants in the beta function of order one. I mean, mm-hmm. And you can then ask, well, how do you know that at the scale you started, they were in fact all the same strength? And you don't know that.
So it's no a posteriori argument why they're better than the other ones. The relative.
I don't mm-hmm. think that that's true.
Mm-hmm.
It also depends on what you start. Right. Okay.
Do you assume that quarks have opposite, which they have opposite spin? Or do you allow for power spin as well?
We have considered. Those blue quarks which were left over, the condensate that they form involves parallel spin, and that interaction is much much weaker. It's very weakly attractive. Now I can't remember whether the authors that I was just quoting consider this possibility or not. I can't remember.
So it's a kind of P weight rather than S.
Right. There's several possibilities. You can have S equals 1 and L equals 0, which will be J equals 1. Or you can also think of S equals 1, L equals 1 with J equals 0. Many such possibilities have been discussed. I'm telling you the ones that are most attractive, which is not to say that some of the other ones don't form with smaller gaps. Okay. Now, the final improvement that I wanted to mention is the one case where I would say the model being used is not a toy model. That you can ask a question. You can ask the question, what really happens when you go to large densities, and ask what happens with one gluon exchange in the limit that G goes to zero. And this, I think, it's fair to say because by one gluon exchange here, I really do mean one gluon exchange, not a four Fermi interaction modeling one gluon exchange. This is beyond the toy model state. This is beyond toy model status. And this question, it was thought that this question had been answered a long time ago by Balin and Love. And what they did was to introduce by hand an electric and magnetic mass. And if you do that, or equivalently, if you just model the interaction as a four Fermi model one gluon exchange as a four Fermi interaction, then you get, other than some constant out front, a gap equation with exactly the same structure as before. And I want to count powers of G now. I want to follow the G. So if I just look at this, what this equation becomes is an equation like this. And I then find the very familiar result that the gap goes like e to the minus 1 over G squared. To get this result, I either had to model the interaction as a four Fermi interaction, or equivalently, I had to put in electric and magnetic masses. And if I put in electric and magnetic masses, then on long enough wavelengths, this one gluon exchange looks like a point-like interaction. But at high densities, as opposed to high temperatures, there is no magnetic mass in the absence of superconductivity. A superconductor gives you a magnetic mass by the Higgs mechanism, but in the absence of the superconductivity, there's no magnetic mass. This is a point which I think was realized by many people. It was pointed out in a recent paper by Pizarski and Rischke and explained in more detail by Son. So how do you do things right? given the fact that in the absence of superconductivity, you have a long-range magnetic interaction. What Son showed, this is his result, and if you want to hear, I'll give a one transparency description on the next transparency, but he's right here, so you should ask him to give a talk if you want more than one transparency. What he showed was that this long-range interaction gives you a condensate which goes like e to the minus 1 over g, not g squared. That's what I'm... You mean the running of the coupling? Yeah, well, the way that this analysis was done was to ask about renormalization in the sense of starting with a G at some scale lambda and ask what happens as you run towards the Fermi surface. But what you're asking is the fact that as you take mu very large, G changes. The G at the scale that you would start with here changes as you make mu very large. That was not taken into account. I mean, I think to lowest order, presumably you should plug in the one loop beta function for G evaluated at a momentum transfer mu. You should read this as G of mu. Mu is the chemical potential. It's the Fermi surface. It's the momentum scale in the problem. Okay, and Son was able to calculate this coefficient. How can I show you in one transparency that this is a reasonable result without getting the coefficient right? What Son did was, I shouldn't call it a full renormalization group treatment. Son did a full one-loop renormalization group treatment. What I'm going to do is give you a sketch here. The gap equation that you get when you include a propagating gluon instead of just a four fermion interaction turns out to have this qualitative structure, and I'm fudging a little bit. The details are all in Son's paper. There's this piece which is familiar, but then there is an additional divergence having to do with the fact that at small angle scattering, basically the gluon propagator gives you a 1 over q squared. I guess in this notation it should have been 1 over p minus q squared. And this gives you, when you do the momentum integral, when you do the angular part of the momentum integral, there's a collinear infrared divergence, precisely. And if I don't cut this off, this right-hand side is infinite. So what cuts it off? One thing that would cut it off is, in fact, the magnetic mass generated by the condensate itself. It turns out that what Son shows is that that's not the most important effect. What the most important effect is the fact that due to Landau damping, this 1 over q squared propagator becomes a 1 over q squared plus something here, which is 0 in the q naught goes to 0 limit, but nevertheless, but for any q naught in this line here, which is non-zero, you get a term here. And MD is the Debye mass. Sorry, this is the Debye mass squared. So this is the mass for... This, well, are you asking how to calculate MD squared? Thank you. Son? I'm butchering his paper here by trying to get to the answer in one transparency, but basically what happens is that however you cut it, this physics introduces a cutoff on the theta integral. And if you had done the naive thing of putting in the magnetic mass generated by the Higgs mechanism, your cutoff here would be theta bigger than delta over mu. Instead, you get this delta over mu to the 1/3 power, and this 1/3 turns out to affect the answer. It turns out to affect the coefficient of the exponent, but if you don't care about the coefficient of the exponent, you can forget about this 1/3 and then just use the magnetic mass generated by the Higgs mechanism. So I could have written here q squared plus something proportional to delta squared, which would then give theta bigger than delta over mu. And so if I now look at this gap equation, I have two logs on the right-hand side. And so when I solve this for delta, this delta cancels, and whatever number I have here goes up into the exponent. under a square root sign because of the fact that I have these two logs here. And, sorry, this should be 1 over j. So this, the result is that delta goes like e to the minus number times 1 over g. And what this says is that all previous treatments before this were underestimates in the g goes to 0 limit. It's the physics of Debye screening, which, I mean, Debye screening occurs at high density and at high temperature.
What is the reason that chromomagnetic lightning effect is
less? It's just the fact, it turns out to be the fact that this one third is less than that one. And if you follow through where it. So the lesson to take away from this is that all of the treatments that I've been describing using four Fermi interactions are maybe reasonable phenomenological ways of addressing the question of how large the gap is at non-asymptotic densities, but if you push them to asymptotic densities, you'll get too small an answer. Because the right answer at asymptotic densities goes like e to the minus 1 over g, not e to the minus 1 over g squared. And this raises the interesting question, which is, are we making underestimates even at lower densities? And that would be of interest were it true. The optimist interpretation is everything is bigger than all the plots I've showed you. That would be the optimist interpretation, but that's not demonstrated. What's demonstrated is that very, very high density, everything is bigger than the plots I showed you. Okay. So now I want to go to three flavors. It turns out that everything is different at three flavors. Actually, I'm getting pretty warm. Would someone mind opening a door behind them? It's okay. It's safe. I've done it before. So, all of this is fine that I've been telling you, except for the fact that it's completely unjustified to leave out the strange quark. At high densities, the strange quark mass is presumably of order its current quark mass. Its current mass, say 100 MeV, that's much less than the chemical potential. So there's no reason to neglect it. Well, the chemical potentials I've been using have been 400 MeV, 500 MeV. Furthermore, I didn't show it, but we actually considered cases in which, this is an answer to someone's question, in the two-flavor case, we put in a non-zero quark mass, and we found that our results were not affected as long as the quark mass we put in was a lot less than the chemical potential. And that suggests that if I'm interested in chemical potentials much larger than the strange quark mass, a reasonable starting point is actually QCD with three massless quarks. And that's what I'll discuss for the next bit of the talk. So now instantons are a six-leg vertex. They certainly contribute to chiral symmetry breaking still at zero density. But because they're a six-leg interaction, they turn out to be formally irrelevant at the Fermi surface, although they will still play a role. So if we want to do something like what we did before, we have to introduce a four Fermi interaction, which is not the instanton interaction. And so we fell back on a four Fermi interaction modeled on one gluon exchange. And again, the renormalization group analysis of all possible interactions has not really been done in this case yet. So what is the attractive channel that we found? Alpha is a color index, beta is a flavor index. Let me just look at what happens to the left-handed quarks first. It turns out that the left-handed quarks form a condensate, which has this structure. And now you say, well, wait a minute, I've got a delta function here between a color index and a flavor index. And in fact, I have that all over the place. So if I ask, what does this condensate do to the symmetries? Well, it locks SU3 left to color in the sense that this object is invariant if I make a simultaneous SU3 rotation on the left flavor and on color. But were I to make a different rotation on SU3 left than I did on color, that would not be a symmetry of this condensate. So this condensate breaks SU3 color cross SU3 left down to SU3 color plus left. Now, there's another condensate involving the right-handed quarks, which does the same thing for the right-handed quarks. So this condensate breaks SU3 color cross SU3 right down to SU3 color plus right. And now because color is the same color, you have locked left to right through color. So in other words, you've broken SU3 color cross SU3 left cross SU3 right down to a diagonal subgroup SU3 color plus left plus right. So even though there's no psi bar psi condensate, these are only dichroic condensates, no psi bar psi condensate, you have broken chiral symmetry. So what are the consequences of this symmetry breaking pattern? First of all, unlike before, previously only the red and green quarks were affected. Now all three color quarks and all three flavor quarks are affected. So all 9 quarks have a gap now. Second of all 8 gluons get a mass by the Higgs interaction, by the Higgs mechanism, I'm sorry. If you count generators, I didn't mention, you break a U1 also. You break a U1 associated with baryon number. So you started with 24 generators, that's 3 times 8, plus 1 is 25. The unbroken group is just a single SU3, so I must have broken 17 symmetries. 8 of the Nambu-Goldstone bosons got eaten by giving mass to the 8 gluons, so there should be 9 massless Nambu-Goldstone modes. 8 of them have the quantum numbers of the pi, the k, and the eta. They're associated with the breaking of chiral symmetry. There's one left over, and that's the Goldstone mode that always happens, that always occurs when you break a U1, a particle number U1. In other words, it's this phase is both a superconductor, because you've broken a gauge symmetry. It's a superfluid, because you've broken a U1, a global U1. And it's a chiral symmetry breaking phase, because you broke this symmetry. So it has all of these features. These Nambu-Goldstone modes will dominate the low energy physics. They're the lightest degrees free. They're the lightest excitations. They do, in fact, get a mass. If you neglect instantons, they get a mass whose square, the mass squared goes like the quark mass squared. When you include the instantons, you have to put in a diagram like this, which can generate a... So in this phase, you will actually generate a small psi bar psi condensate via this six-leg interaction here. Here's q bar q linked to a qq and a q bar q bar. So in the presence of these two condensates, which I presented, you will necessarily, this is not surprising. If you break chiral symmetry, there should be a way of making a chiral condensate, and here it is. What about electromagnetism? It turns out that the ordinary electromagnetism is broken, but there is a U1, which is a sum of electromagnetism. So in electromagnetism, quarks have charges determined by their flavors. Up quarks, 2/3, down, minus 1/3, strange, minus 1/3. If you consider on the U1, which is where the charge under that U1 is the sum of this charge plus a charge determined by the color of the quark. So in other words, if you take a U1, which is a subgroup of SU3 color, it's color hypercharge, then under this U1, which is a superposition whose charges are the sums of these, for example, the red quark has charge, the red up is charge 0, green up is charge 1, etc. It turns out that with this charge assignment, first of all, you find that all the quarks have integer charges under this U1, and second of all, you find that the condensate is neutral. So this U1 is an unbroken abelian gauge interaction such that all the quarks and all the Nambu-Goldstone bosons have integer charges under it. So it's like Hund Nambu quarks, if that means something to you. Okay.
You also mentioned the baryon number U1.
Correct.
So what happens to baryon number?
Well, it's broken in the same sense that particle number U1's associated with particle number are broken in any superfluid. No more, no less. Okay. How large a gap do you get? This is harder to normalize because we don't actually know what the right alpha QCD is to use for this 4 Fermi interaction. And to give you some sense, for a given choice of alpha QCD, the dashed line is the chiral condensate that you would get in vacuum. The solid line is the superconducting condensate that you get at a particular density. I don't remember what density this is chosen. And you can see that if I were so bold as to choose a one gluon interaction which was so strong as to generate a chiral symmetry breaking of the observed magnitude, which would be an alpha somewhere here, I would then get a gap which was around 250 MeV. I shouldn't be so bold, but again, this tells you that the natural scales here are superconducting gaps of order 100 MeV, temperatures of order 50 MeV. Okay. So one gets a phase diagram here. This time I can say with confidence that this transition is first order because there's a global change in global symmetry in going from here to here. And if you think about that, what the symmetry is that's being restored there, you can convince yourself that this one must be first order. So to conclude this part of the talk, for three-flavor QCD, we have a phase at high density, which has no light quarks, in the sense that to excite a quark, to create a quark excitation costs you an energy of order the gap, delta. There's no massless gluons. To excite a gluon excitation costs you energy G delta, because of the Higgs mechanism. Chiral symmetry is broken, so there's light pions. There's, in addition, a massless U1 associated with the breaking of baryon number. There's a modified massless photon. And the phase diagram that I drew before implied a first-order transition here, and the reason prior to a month or two ago, I would have said there's definitely a transition here is I would have said baryon number is broken here, it's not broken there. But Schaefer and Wilczek just wrote a paper in which they pointed out that if you think about nuclear matter, in nuclear matter you can easily have nucleon-nucleon pairing, very standard, well-studied phenomenon, which in this three-flavor theory might be Cooper pairs of lambdas, say. In neutron stars, you get Cooper pairs of neutrons. That you get neutron superfluidity in neutron stars. In this three-flavor world, you get you can have breaking of U1 superfluidity and therefore the breaking of U1 baryon in nuclear matter. So what Schaefer and Wilczek suggest is the following very amusing possibility, which I wouldn't say is demonstrated, but it's definitely worth thinking about, which is that the phase diagram may in fact look like this, at least topologically speaking. That here one has nuclear matter, and out here one has high-density quark matter with color flavor locking. And because both of them have chiral symmetry breaking and both of them have U1 baryon number breaking, there need not be any transition between them. So this suggests that even if you don't care about high-density QCD in the sense of neutron stars, you may not give a damn about neutron stars, but you may be interested in calculating physics associated with chiral symmetry breaking and confinement. Of course, you'd be interested in calculating things about the QCD vacuum. You can't get there from here, but you can get down in density at least as far as nuclear matter density without a transition, perhaps. And so that would suggest that you can at least you have found a phase of matter which has chiral symmetry breaking and confinement, which is weakly coupled. It's certain, the physics is non-perturbative, but the G is small. So things are calculable. And you can calculate and learn qualitative things here which are then continuously connectable, not to the vacuum, but to nuclear matter. And to make this connection striking, I'll point out, this one is obvious that the Goldstone modes are the same. That's obvious. That's a consequence of symmetry. But it's actually even more striking than that. If you look at the vector mesons down here, you would have an octet and a singlet. Up here, you have an octet with mass G delta. Don't quite know what happens to this missing singlet. As you go from here to here, this combination of the rho and the omega, the singlet combination, must either get much heavier or get much broader and somehow disappear if you are to go from this to this continuously. Now, what about the baryons? On this side, I have 8 quarks with mass delta. And a 9th quark with a... It turns out I didn't show you this. When you do the calculation, you find for the... There are 9 gaps. 8 of them are the same. 1 is different. The one that's different is about twice as large as the 8 that are the same. So you can easily imagine that the 8 baryons over here continuously become the 8 quarks over here. And notice that when I say quark here, this is quark in a phase where there's a diquark condensate, so there's no way of telling the difference between 1 quark and 3. So it's very easy to imagine that you could continuously go from this phase to this phase in this theory. And this was the sense in which I said Berendt was prescient earlier in the talk.
Is it obvious when both condensates are possible that one cannot cancel the other? That you would always stay with the lambda fast condensate and not get it all the back walk?
Well, the quantum numbers are precisely the same. The condensate which forms here, the condensate which forms out here in flavor, in the presence of the condensate that I described, you can ask what's the expectation value of a UDS-UDS operator, and it's non-zero. So, there's no issue of... it's the same phase. The point is that these might be the same phase.
But you're...
By the way, I keep saying might because it's also a logical possibility that there's a first-order transition here. No one has the analog of what Bergus and I did of, well, that was in a toy model, but anyway, even in a toy model of doing some sort of a toy model, which, and the difficulty, of course, is what's the toy model you're going to use for nuclear matter? That's the hard part. I can come up with a toy model that works up here, but I don't actually know how to do a toy model which would, in any convincing way...
They've been doing toy models for years.
Yes, I know.
They don't have lambda.
Anyway, I think this is very interesting, and I wanted to show it to you. What is to be done? Clearly, three massless quarks and two massless quarks led to different physics, so we damn well better consider the possibility of two massless quarks and a third strange quark with a non-zero strange quark mass. This is work in progress. This is work in progress. It's just messier. It's not harder than what's been done before. It's work in progress by, I think, perhaps more than one group, but certainly by Alfred Bergus and I. Another thing that you should really do is this: at high density, you have a microscopic theory, so you should be able to calculate the coefficients of the Ginzburg-Landau theory describing the long wavelength excitations. This is doable, has not yet been done. There's lots of interesting physics to do with neutron stars in this, which we have made sort of, we've written sentences about, but no one has done calculations on yet. One obvious possibility is that how do neutron stars cool? They cool by emitting neutrinos. When you have a gap at the Fermi surface, that affects neutrino emission. This I could tell you more about if people are interested. What is neutron stars have magnetic fields. What's the behavior of a magnetic field if you have a neutron star with this stuff at its middle? The fact that there's a modified photon in this phase, does that affect neutron star physics in any interesting way? Not known. Now, for this workshop, what about non-equilibrium physics? Well, a very interesting question is, how does this condensate form during a supernova collapse? You make a neutron star, this condensate should grow out from the center. That's certainly non-equilibrium physics, not studied. And finally, inspired by Kuzenko and Garcia Bolido's considerations of the dynamics of a proton-proton condensate, basically they consider the ultimate heavy ion collision. They consider neutron star mergers, which is the ultimate heavy ion collision. And in that context, they thought about the dynamics not of the condensates that I've been describing, but just of the ordinary proton-proton superconducting condensate. And they made some very interesting speculations, and I think this suggests that this physics should be thought of in light of the kinds of condensates that I've been describing. And Juan is here, so you can ask him about that if there's interest. Okay. Well, because this leads directly to experimental predictions, I think I'm going to try and, in a few minutes, say a little bit about this other physics that I wanted to talk about. I thought I'd have a little more time, but namely, what happens near this tricritical point. So now, forget physics out here, and let's go up here to this point at non-zero temperature and density, where this ordinary chiral symmetry restoration temperature changes order. So no more superconductivity. Let's just ask about this physics. How does one describe physics near this tricritical point? It turns out that I learned much of this from Professor Laurie, Professor Laurie's review on the subject, which I recommend. The way to describe the physics here is in terms of an effective theory in which you have a phi squared term, a phi fourth term, and a phi sixth term. Why? Well, how do I describe a second order transition? I would have this term and this term, and as I dial the temperature, there is some temperature at which A vanishes, and assuming B is positive, then that at the temperature where A vanishes, I have a second order transition. That's what happens here. But now I have two knobs to turn. I have T and mu. I have two knobs to turn, so because I have two knobs to turn, there should be some point where both A and B vanish. So let's ask, what happens when B is negative? If B is negative, then as I vary A, you get a first order phase transition, as long as C is positive. So what that tells you is that when B is positive, I have second order behavior. When B is negative, I have first order behavior. When A and B both vanish, I have a tricritical point. So what this means is that the long wavelength effective theory at this point is phi to the sixth field theory in three dimensions. And phi to the sixth field theory in three dimensions is mean field. So even I can calculate the critical exponents associated with this point. Now, add a quark mass. If I add a quark mass, it's a well-known story that this second-order transition goes away. You tilt the Mexican hat, it's like adding, turning on an external magnetic field in a ferromagnet, and a second order transition becomes a smooth crossover. But if I ask what can happen to a first order transition if I turn on a small perturbation, a small magnetic field, it must still be a first order transition. It in fact moves to the right. I won't demonstrate that it moves to the right, but it does move to the right. So the phase diagram we end up with in a theory with not two massless quarks but with two light quarks is one in which there's a first order line ending at a critical point E. So this is like the liquid gas phase diagram from your childhood. It's one in which you expect critical opalescence to occur here, long wavelength fluctuations with exponents in the Ising model universality class. So what this suggests is that the transition, phase transition in QCD may be second order for heavy ion collisions with mu just right. And for those of you like me who spent a lot of time thinking about approximately second order phase transitions on the vertical axis and thought about non-equilibrium physics there and had a lot of disoriented chiral condensate fun, it's what's really nice is that here you don't have to go to non-equilibrium to get actual true second order behavior. That was a side remark, but anyway. So how should we look for this critical endpoint E? This is the analog of the question, how would I find the critical opalescence? This is work that I did with Misha Stefanov and Edward Shuryak. So what we did was to use the two related characteristic properties of physics near E, namely that the specific heat diverges and that one has long wavelength oscillations. These are really the same thing, of course. Before I answer the question of how to find this, I should say something about the strange quark mass. Let me not justify the following statement. It turns out that you can argue that bringing the strange quark mass from infinity down from infinity sucks this tricritical point to the left. And so whatever tricritical point we think we have in a two-flavor theory, the tricritical point in nature will be to the left of that. And this is consistent with something which I said, which nobody asked me, which is if when you get to three massless quarks, this transition is thought to be first order all the way up. So as you bring MS down from infinity, this point P gets sucked to the left until at some MS star, it's all the way over here on the vertical axis, and then you have then no more tricritical point. It's all first order. And so to talk to experimentalists, it's important to tell them at what mu to look. So at what mu should they look? Well, the mu's for the tricritical point that we found when we had no strange quark mass, this is in models, was up around 600, 700 MeV. To set the scale, what chemical potentials are explored by experiments? And in present experiments at the AGS, if I just, all these numbers have caveats, which I'm not going to tell you. If I just ask my experimental colleagues, what mu do you think you have, and tell them, don't tell me any caveats, they give me this number for present fixed target experiments at Brookhaven, and this number for present fixed target experiments at CERN. So what that tells you is if you can do this and you can do this, you can obviously do anything in between. You just have to lower the energy of the accelerator at CERN. So what this suggests is that the critical point in nature, namely nature with its physical value of the strange quark mass, may be at an accessible chemical potential between that explored at Brookhaven and that explored at CERN. So the idea here is to compare three different heavy ion collisions in this figure, say, in one of which I created conditions here, the next one there. This plasma cooled through the first order region, so did this one cooled through the crossover. And you can imagine then a special case where you cool right through the critical point E. And I should say, for those of you who don't think about heavy ion physics regularly, that as you crank the accelerator up, you of course go to higher initial temperatures, you also go to lower chemical potentials, because say when I get to RIC, which will presumably be up here somewhere, I'll have 10,000 pions per event, baryon number 400, so the baryon density in units that matter is small. So as I go to higher and higher collision energy, my baryon density in the units that matter goes down because I make more and more pions. So that's a way of seeing, and this is consistent with what I said before, so AGS might be somewhere over here, and SPS might, on this axis, AGS might be over here, and SPS might be somewhere over there. the cosmology is at mu equals zero, and Rick is getting pretty close to cosmology. But for exploring this physics, I actually don't want to get to mu equals zero. Okay, I'll skip that. What are the signatures? We propose several, I will tell you two. The things that we propose are direct reflections of thermodynamics. Other more detailed signatures can surely be found. The first idea is look at the fluctuations in the event-by-event temperature. Now, you cannot measure the temperature of a single event, but you can measure some physical observable which is well correlated with temperature. You might measure the mean transverse momentum. And for an infinite system in thermal equilibrium, T is a constant. But for a finite system, there are fluctuations in T, and I go look in Landau and Lipschitz, and they tell me that delta T goes like 1 over root CV, where CV is the extensive heat capacity. So the fact that this is extensive means that delta T goes like 1 over root N, N is the number of particles, as you expect. But in particular, at a critical point where CV diverges, delta T goes to 0. So what you would do is I would do a series of experiments at different energies, and at each energy I would measure a distribution, an event-by-event distribution of some physical observable that's well correlated with temperature. I would get a width of that distribution, which is a measure of the fluctuation from event to event of that quantity. I would expect that distribution to narrow when you get close to the critical point and then widen when you pass it. We calculated exponents. Well, calculate is the wrong word. We enumerated the exponents which describe this physics. We enumerated the exponents which describe this physics by considering the Ising model, which is what describes this endpoint. In Ising model language, this direction now becomes the reduced temperature, and this direction the applied magnetic field. And so it turns out that two different susceptibilities come in. The one with the larger exponent wins. And this is explained in the paper. The other qualitatively different signature is, what is the manifestation of those long wavelength sigmas? Well, what's amusing is that if you freeze out near TC, you will have a lot of sigmas around because they're almost massless. And because they're almost massless, they can't decay into 2 pi's, which is what sigmas normally do. But later, as the plasma expands a little further, the sigma mass rises as the density goes down and the temperature goes down. And there will come a time, a few Fermis later, when the sigma mass gets above 2 pions, twice the pion mass. The sigmas then decay. These pions are produced late and don't thermalize. So you would expect a non-thermal excess of low-momentum pions. In a paper in preparation, we actually estimate the mean transverse momentum of these pions, and it's about half the pion mass. So to summarize, I'm going quickly, but to summarize, what we're proposing to the experimental community is to vary the energy, for example, to look at energies between those explored at Brookhaven and CERN, and to look for non-monotonic behavior in signatures of the kind that we propose, in particular at the width of event-by-event fluctuations. So measure the T in quotes for a million events. That's been done. Basically, well, measure the T in quotes for a million events, get a distribution which has a width. Plot the width with the root N taken out versus collision energy, and look for a dip. What's really nice about this signature is that it's non-monotonic, and thus hard to fake by purely hadronic processes. If I was just saying this curve went down or this curve went up, that's much more easily fakeable than when I say that a curve goes down and then comes back up. All of this can be done with a real detector, which exists. And just for the theorists in the room, I think it's important that I show you the real world. That's a heavy ion collision. That's data. It's not simulation. Data from the NA49 experiment at CERN. So this is lead on lead fixed target at 160 GeV per nucleon. So the interaction occurred just off the bottom of the transparency. There are magnetic fields. There are 3 spectrometers here, here, and here. So the tracks are curved in these regions, and they're straight where they're yellow. And
these are all pions.
These are charged particles. 85% of which are pions. So to you and I, they can be all pions. And the experimentalist made me promise that if I show that one, I have to show the transparencies that show that this really is analyzable. You can start to get an idea that they can track if you sort of look at it this way. And if you zoom in and look at the data out of one of their spectrometers, you really can begin to see that they can, in fact, follow individual tracks. they can measure the transverse momentum of these particles, and they can in fact do particle identification at some level also, which is where that 85% number comes from. And so the experimental status, this is actually, I don't think this is preliminary anymore. They have done this analysis that we want them to do at one energy. At 160 GeV, they know the width of that distribution. Suited with the root n scaled out, it's in suitable units, it's 0.74. And what we say is, do that again, but not just at this energy, but at a variety of energies, and look and see how this width varies with energy. And look for it to drop and then come back up. I won't give you the arguments, but you can ask, how much do you expect it to drop? And the right way of asking that question is, how much of the presently observed width is thermodynamic, and thus could be decreased if the specific heat were to increase? And we made an estimate which basically suggests that the observed width is of the same order of magnitude as what you expect from thermodynamics. So there are two logical possibilities for this one green data point. This green data point is the width observed at one energy. My guess is that we have this sort of situation where if they lower the energy, they'll see a dip. The other logical possibility is, of course, this. With only one data point, you can't tell whether you have this situation or this one. So they need more data points. Were they to find these signatures, you would learn that there's a genuine critical point in nature. You would furthermore learn something which is relevant for cosmology and lattice simulations, namely that on the vertical axis you have a crossover. You would furthermore learn that in QCD with two massless quarks you have a tricritical point, which is amusing to many of us. And finally, a trivial corollary but one of great interest is that if you learn that you froze out near that critical point, that means you started above it. And if you started above it, that allows you to interpret many other signatures with much greater confidence. As should be obvious, one of the biggest questions that remains is, could this story be completely upset by non-equilibrium effects? And I hope that this is a question which will get attention over the next year or so.
Do you have any gut feeling?
I think that there are all kinds of effects that can reduce this. But if I ask the experimentalists how well do they know the width, they tell me that they have measured their width to about 1 or 2%. And so the question is, how big is the effect that remains after you beat at it with finite size effects and non-equilibrium this and messy that? And the nice thing is that if you don't beat at it with anything, the change in the width that you predict from this is of order the width itself. So it can take a lot of beating and still be above 1 or 2%. But time will tell. So to conclude, I won't say anything more about color superconductivity. I concluded that part of my talk already. The conclusion for the experimental part of this talk is, it's worth, as you're lying in bed at night, thinking about the following picture. It may well be that present experiments at Brookhaven have poked at the first order region, probably not got through it. And present experiments at CERN, which have actually seen many interesting hints but nothing quite conclusive, may in fact be exploring a region where there's in fact a smooth crossover. If this is the case, it's probably a bad idea at CERN to ask yourself whether you are or are not above a non-existent line. A much better thing to do at CERN is to lower your energy a little bit and look for the red dot. Your other strategy, of course, is to build RIC. By the time you get to RIC, your initial conditions are far above the scales I've been talking, so you really can hope for completely qualitatively new physics associated not with the transition region but with the high temperature phase. And I will leave you with that.
Experimentally, of course, it would be extremely interesting to know in what steps you would need to take an interpretation function in order to find that.
Mm-hmm. And this, of course, in this case, finite size effects and finite time effects help us, because they all, any signal gets reduced and broadened by the fact that the real system is messy. The real system is finite in time extent. The real system is finite in size, and also the real system is not spatially homogeneous. So you shouldn't actually be thinking about sharp trajectories on this plot. You should be thinking of schmears, because within a given collision, you will create some schmear of initial conditions which cools. So the only answer to that that I can give is that there's no reason to think you need to take super tiny steps. It's also obviously the case that if you just made, you know, three energies, you might miss it. So I don't know. I can't give a quantitative answer to that question.
What quality would you want to dial? Is it
The quantity that you want to dial is the initial chemical potential, so long as your initial temperature is high enough. And the easiest way of dialing that is to dial the collision energy, because I know by comparing AGS to SPS that when I go from AGS energies to SPS energies, I change mu by a lot. There are other quantities you can think of dialing. One is the rapidity. You could imagine comparing forward rapidity to central rapidity. Another is the centrality. You could imagine comparing collisions in which the nuclei hit dead on to those in which there's a non-zero impact parameter. In both those cases, in the second case, in the case of centrality, the lore is that by changing centrality, you don't change mu very much, but you change your initial temperature. So a central collision maybe starts here, and a somewhat peripheral collision starts here. Now, if that lore is correct, then it's not a good knob to dial, but you shouldn't always believe lore, so it's worth dialing that knob and looking at widths and seeing how they change. But based on what people think they know, the best thing to dial is the collision energy.
Sometimes data in these experiments, thermal equilibrium goes much slower.
Yeah. Sure. You're asking about processes at much earlier times than the ones that I've been describing. If you do, say, a parton cascade calculation, which is supposed to describe the early physics of a Rick collision, what you find, for those of you who missed what Hector said, what you find is that you relatively rapidly thermalize the momenta of the partons. So you have a Boltzmann distribution of momentum, isotropic in momentum space, but you have too many gluons relative to the number of quarks. It takes longer to produce the QQ bar pairs that you need to get into chemical equilibrium. I don't believe that is the kind of physics that is... The kind of question that I would worry about is actually not that at all. The kind of question that I would worry about in this case is, as you go through these sorts of temperatures during the cooling, have you achieved local thermal equilibrium? Very likely, yes. Have you achieved equilibrium at very long wavelengths? Very likely, no. And certainly based on, which I didn't talk about at all in this talk, I've done a lot of work on DCC physics, that's predicated on the guess that at very long wavelengths you haven't achieved thermal equilibrium. And so some of those signatures of the tricritical point that I talked about involved long wavelength pions. And so there, my own feeling is that we haven't yet analyzed the problem sufficiently. And I don't act, but what I would still say is that the thing to do is to look for changes in the physics of long wavelength pions that come and then go. As you crank the collision energy up, you look for non-monotonic behavior. And it may be that we haven't quite made the right prediction for the best thing to look at, because we haven't taken into account non-equilibrium effects. But it still should be the case that as you go from here to here, there will be physics which is different around here, and thus non-monotonic signatures in the low-momentum pions. The way that we've done the analysis by blindly assuming thermal equilibrium period is probably insufficient to get all the details right. But I don't actually think it has too much to do with what goes on up here. Yeah? Yes, I can tell you that. Good. Let me find a. Well, actually, this will do. So this is drawn for the case when the quark masses are non-zero. But let me redraw this in your mind for the case when there's a zero quark mass. So this is first order and then second order.
Yeah.
So imagine that. Now I need to have a third axis sticking out of the plane, which is the quark mass. And so if you think of that quark mass as a parameter, then this whole symmetry plane is a line of coexistence between I mean, that's the magnetic field in magnet language. So the analog here is the quark mass. The analog here is the quark mass. That's the term which is linear in the order parameter.
There's no difference between
Psi by psi being plus a number and psi by psi being minus that number. I mean, this is a fermion mass. Its sign doesn't matter.
But you are saying there are really two equilibrium states.
Yes. Yes, when the symmetry is broken. So once I have a non-zero psi bar psi, you know, the statement of symmetry breaking, how do you make that statement precise? Because I have a continuous symmetry that I'm breaking. You say I introduce a small explicit symmetry breaking and take the limit as that goes to zero. And the answer you will get will depend on whether you chose a positive small symmetry breaking or a negative small symmetry breaking. And those are the two phases which you can think of as coexisting here. And now, what is actually drawn here is, of course, a slice of this three-dimensional plot at non-zero quark mass. So, and once I get to non-zero quark mass, this has gone away. I've moved out in this magnetic field direction and broken the symmetry explicitly, and then that is, in fact, what's supposed to be drawn here.
So, if you really want to study critical opalescence, if I have a very small little drop of water and I demand that you do your experiment very rapidly,
yes.
There's obviously a threshold in which you give up and you say it's impossible.
Correct.
It seems like there should be a translation.
There's a natural QCD scale. Call it lambda QCD, call it F pi, call it what you will, call it one Fermi. Heavy ion collisions initially, before any expansion, the two nuclei have each nucleus has a diameter, say, of 14 Fermi. There will then, by the time we get to this point, there will already have been a little bit of expansion. But anyway, you certainly have one decade to play with, maybe a little bit more. Another way of saying it is, in these SPS collisions, if you ask how many pions are there, the answer is about 2,000. It's not 10 to the 23, but it's better than three. So it then just becomes a quantitative question. Is 2,000 good enough? And if you don't like 2,000, wait for Rick when there'll be 10,000. If you don't like 10,000, wait for LHC when there'll be many tens of thousands.
Yeah, but that's not really helping you with this critical
figure. I know. That's right. But I should say, by the way, it's a logical possibility that this red dot is here. Right? I mean, should you believe me to within a factor of two? No, you shouldn't. What I can say is I can talk about universal physics that occurs near the red dot. Where the red dot is a non-universal question, and the experimentalists are supposed to tell me the answer to that question. If they don't find it between here and here, one can hope that they find it between Rick and SPS. But in terms of the next year, SPS can hopefully make some interesting statements. In terms of the next few years, the game moves across to this side of the Atlantic. Well, the kinds of fluctuation signatures that I described would not be stronger here, because what you're sensitive to, the kinds of things I talked about, you're sensitive to physics at freeze-out. And the freeze-out here is occurring in the hadronic phase. So the specific heat is not especially large here, just as it's not especially large there. But here, you hope basically that the specific heat is larger here than it is there or there. So for the kinds of signatures I was talking about, actually, they're not dramatic over here. But then you can ask about other signatures. You can ask about, say, signatures in hydrodynamic flow associated with strong first-order phase transitions. I'm not an expert on that subject, but I'm not an expert on that subject. Let me just say I'm not an expert on that subject. There are other signatures which the most optimistic thing that one can say about AGS is that they might have been pushing into this. Well, I don't know. I'm out of my depth here. But no one from the AGS experimental community has stepped forward and said, we've seen a convincing signature of a strong first-order phase transition. So it may be that they've just sort of been poking into the mixed phase a little bit. It may not, but I'm beyond my depth now.
If you're going into mixed phase, then you know you are exactly at fixed depth. There's no fluctuation.
I don't think anybody thinks that the AGS has gone to the other side of the mixed phase. But again, as you know, as in any experimental situation, at any given moment in time, not all things that experiments tell you are right. So, I'm sort of telling you, if I go and ask my experimental colleagues what do they tell me, that doesn't mean you should necessarily believe everything that they say. But if I ask them, their best guess is that you're poking into the mixed phase. Or if I either ask them or if I ask theorists who are closer to them than I. Some of whom are in this room if they'd like to speak up.
I think we should take a short break and come back.